Chapter 2. Of all the things John expected to walk in on when he slipped up to the Firespray 31 at the far edge of the tiny port, this isn't it. Raising a brow, he pauses at the edge of the cleared ring of pavement that just peaks above the swamp, watching one of the Jedi Order's most dangerous enemies howl in outrage as his son tackles him backwards into a shallow pool of clean water. Jango is shirtless, stripped down and streaked with grease, but he's grinning, and Boba is laughing wickedly, wrestling him down. He only gets a moment to savor his victory, though, before Jango is lunging back to his feet, hauling Boba up and over his shoulder and twisting to dump him in a pile of soggy bedding that looks like it's been recently washed. Instantly, Boba shrieks in anger, clawing his way up out of the pile and grabs for a bucket full of sudsy water that's sitting near him. He rises, advances. "Boba," Jango warns, retreating with narrowed eyes. "Don't you dare. I'll hang you from the gun turret." "The idea of punishment shouldn't stop a determined warrior," Boba says, smirking. It sounds like a quote, and from the offense that crosses Jango's face, John can guess the source. "You shouldn't let most punishment stop you, maybe, but I'm your father and I can end you." Boba throws the water, bucket and all, right at his father, and Jango throws himself to the side, hits the ground, and rolls back to his feet. He grabs for a hose, and Boba shrieks in dismay, but he's in the middle of open ground with no cover. He braces. It's madness and frivolous, but John raises a hand. The bucket flips upward, drops down right in the path of the water just as the hose turns on, and it reflects a vast, wide spray of water that drenches Jango instantly. He shouts in offense, and Boba whoops, launching himself forward right at his father. His full weight hits Jango around the waist, and Jango goes down, landing hard on his back with Boba on his chest. With a wheeze, he drops his head back, and Boba raises both arms with a sound of victory, then scrambles up and turns to John, grinning. "Perfect timing, John," he says smugly. John snorts, flicking a finger. The bucket soars up, then drops down, and it settles over Boba's head with a light thump.
"Congratulations on your victory," he says, amused.
And Boba huffs and hauls the bucket off, giving him a dirty look. "So you're on his side now?" he demands.
"I'm an agent of chaos," John says mildly.
And Boba rolls his eyes. It makes John smile, just a little, and he sweeps a look over the landing pad, the clear signs of a thorough cleaning that are happening, and says,
"Should I come back later?"
"No," Boba says quickly, dropping the bucket. "I can work on the scanners right now. Dad's bounty isn't going to be here for another week, so we're just scrubbing."
"The ship or each other?" John asks dryly,
and Boba pulls a face at him. "I don't have to help you find your swamp monsters," he says pointedly.
"So you volunteered my ship to help a Jedi?" Jango asks, rolling to his feet. He gives John a wary, sidelong look, then apparently decides his blaster is close enough at hand and heads towards a disassembled panel by the ramp.
Boba smirks. "It's gonna be my ship in the future," he points out. "So it's more like I volunteered my half of our ship to help a Jedi." Jango's breath is exasperated.
"That's not how that works," he tells his son. "Don't drip all over the controls, Boba."
"I'll get a towel," Boba says, rolling his eyes. But he grabs John's sleeve and drags him forward. "Come on, you can help me figure out what I'm looking for. Slave One has some of the best scanners in the system, so they pick up everything." John slants a sideways glance at Jango, but the man seems to be pointedly ignoring them, so he lets Boba haul him up the ramp and into the ship. It's clearly in the process of being scrubbed down, and he mines a few suspiciously dark spots on the grating as Bobo leads him towards the front. The seats there are clearly well-worn, like the whole ship, but carefully maintained, and Bobo leaves him there, ducking into the bunk room to grab a towel. John very carefully doesn't touch anything, because he's heard plenty of stories about Slave One's booby traps, and he's not about to test them. "You said there were Vornskers, right?" Boba asks as he comes back, towel draped over his head and clothes still wet. He climbs up in the pilot's seat, then leans forward, hitting buttons, and after a moment, a display rises over the controls, points of light dotting the map of the town. John makes a quiet sound of agreement, leaning forward. "Some of them," he says, and ignores the majority of the dots, instead studying the scattered ones at the very outskirts of the display. Instinctive, immediate, he knows which one is the Katarn he's been hunting. It took a fisherman 2 days ago and has been keeping to the deepest, most impenetrable parts of the swamp since. This, though, could be its den, and John just needs to get there so he can deal with it. "I can recalibrate your scanners, too, if you want," Boba offers, watching him. "Or Dad can. He's really good at it." "I don't have a ship," John says absently, tracing another set of paired heat signatures that he's certain belong to the Vornskers. There's nothing else that catches his attention, though, which likely means the rest of the chrysalids are far enough from the town that he can focus on these three for now. "What?" Boba asks in confusion, brows furrowing. "How do you get here, then?"
"I bartered passage on a cargo freighter,"
John says, and when Boba gives him an incredulous look, he raises a brow.
"Jedi don't have possessions."
Boba doesn't look like this makes things better. "Doesn't the Order have ships, though?" he demands. "Why don't you just use one of those?" John shakes his head, straightening, and fixes the position of the three chrysalids in his memory.
"I don't go to Coruscant," he says, "and I don't deal with the rest of the Order much. They don't come to the Outer Rim, and I won't leave it."
There's a thump of metal being set down, and Jango snorts loudly, disparaging. "And what's one Jedi supposed to be able to do?" he asks. When John turns, Jango is watching him, eyes dark, something angry in his face. "They'd killed his best friend," Boba had said. And John's heard enough stories of Galadron to believe it without hesitation. The truth of what happened there is something that likely only Jango knows. And John wants to ask, but he has enough respect not to.
"Not much," John says quietly and inclines his head to Jango. Then tells Boba, "Thank you. I'm grateful for your assistance." And steps away.
Jango is blocking the path back out of the ship, and John hesitates, not wanting to shove past him. Jango clearly sees it. His mouth curves, not a friendly expression, and he asks, "Then why come out here at all?" For a long moment, John weighs his answers. He could say duty or orders, because both are true. He's a Jedi, and he's never been anything else, and Dark Woman was always very clear that she didn't want John to be another Coruscanti Jedi beholden to the Senate, but...
"Because if I can save one person, that makes it worthwhile," John says quietly.
He considers for a moment, then bows to Jango and says,
"That's what Jedi are for."
There's a long stretch of silence, and then Jango scoffs. The Mandalorians wouldn't have nearly as much of a problem with the Jedi if that were true, he says, but he shifts, and John rises, slips past him, heading for the entrance, but he pauses at the very edge of the ship, one foot on wet pavement, and takes a breath, thinks of the right thing to say, and it's not a pleasant one. It isn't an easy one, but the right thing rarely is. Faye is the one who taught him that, not Dark Woman. The loss of the true Mandalorians was a blow to the galaxy, he says quietly, and hears Jango's sharp breath, a growl, turns, meeting his furious expression as evenly as possible, and says, "The Jedi were tricked. That doesn't remove our responsibility. The whole Order owes you several hundred life debts, Fett, should you ever want to call them in." Jango laughs. And it's a raw, wretched sound, so full of fury that it practically vibrates. Yeah, should I call them up and tell them that? Wait for them to laugh me right out of the damn system? Jedi don't do regret. They definitely don't give a damn about Mandalorians. John hesitates. "I'm not the only one who thinks so," he says after a moment, and it's true. The whole council regrets the debacle on Galadron, and he hates contacting Dark Woman, but she knows just what screws to twist to get them to agree to whatever Jango wants. "I can leave my comm code with you, in case you ever need assistance." "From a Jedi?" Jango bites out. "Get carked." Not an unexpected reaction, given what Jango reportedly lost on Galadron. John bows to him again, accepting that, and turns, heading for the town with steady steps. He'll give Boba his code at some point, when Jango isn't there to see. It's the least he can do, given what happened. In the meantime, there are Sith creatures eating people here. John is only one soul. Can't do much, but that, at least, he can fix, and so he will. It's hard to breathe through the fury, the rage, the grief. Jango presses his fist to the bulkhead, trying to concentrate on each inhale, each slow exhale, but it's hard. He wants to go after the Jedi, to tear his throat out with his bare hands, grind him into the dirt and watch the light leave his eyes. Wants it more than anything, desperate and vicious, and doesn't regret it. All he can see is Miles, cut in half. The massacre, dozens of Jedi slaughtering the true Mandalorians, the last of Jaster's legacy, the last of Jango's family. They were everything, all of Jango's honor and principles given form, and with the loss of them, with Jango's imprisonment. "Dad?" Boba asks tentatively, and a moment later, Jango feels his son's hand on his arm, reaches out, automatic, and wraps an arm around his shoulders, hauling him in tight against his side. "What is it?" he asks, rough in his throat. "Sorry for telling John he could come on the ship," Boba says quietly and leans into Jango's side. Jango breathes out, opens his eyes. "It's fine," he says after a moment. "And it isn't. Nothing will ever be fine again in Jango's world, but he has Boba, and that's more than enough to make him content." There's a long moment of heavy silence as Jango focuses on his son, his ship, the freedom he's earned for himself. Then, soft, almost wary, Boba asks, "Do you ever want to make another group of true Mandalorians?" Jango swallows. He can't say he's never considered it in the depths of the night. The true Mandalorians were Jaster's, and Jango will never not want to honor his father's memory. But at the same time, The true Mandalorians are gone. They died on Galadron, slaughtered because of a trick, and there's no getting them back. They were from Mandalore's army, he says after a moment. Jaster had enough respect to pull them in, but I'm not Mandalore anymore. The new Mandalorians don't even consider me a citizen right now. And that burns in a way Jango hadn't thought it would. When LS had passed on the information, Jango had wanted to rage, to stalk right into the Duchess's fancy palace and drag her out into the real world. The new Mandalorians don't stand for everyone, don't speak for the kind of Mandalorians Jango fought and bled with, and he hates every last one of them and their polished, holier-than-thou ideals. Pacifism isn't the Mandalorian way. Pushing that on everyone in this system just because they think they're better for having rejected all of Mandalore's history and ways is a good way to get dead. And Jango hopes like hell that it happens soon. War isn't the only way to live, but it's the Mandalorian way. And trying to gloss over that just makes those in charge look like blind fools. Idiots, Boba says disgustedly, digging his fingers into Jango's arm like he won't allow himself to be removed. He doesn't say anything for a moment, but then he glances up at Jango and asks, "But if you had the numbers?" Jango lets out a rough breath, brushing his hand over Boba's curls. "Probably," he allows, because there's really nothing else he can say. He gave up on the true Mandalorians for years, but they're Jaster's legacy. Jango lost everything on Galadron, but he still has enough honor and love for his father, even years after his death, to want to keep what Jaster built intact. "What about the clones?" Boba asks, watching him. "If you asked them..." Jango frowns a little, and there's something dark in the pit of his stomach that he refuses to contemplate. "They're clones," he says flatly, "and I have a contract with the Kaminoans. They're soldiers for the Republic, not potential true Mandalorians." "I'm a clone," Boba says, rolling his eyes, though he doesn't let go of Jango. "And Pons was saying they don't have names." Jango interrupts. "Don't they do?" Boba interrupts and finally pulls away. He scowls at Jango. "You're the one who wanted me to train with them." A mistake Jango is coming to regret. It had seemed like the best way to keep Boba out of trouble while Jango was hunting down a bounty, but clearly it went awry in ways Jango probably should have predicted. "That doesn't mean..." "Dad!" Boba gives him a look that's mulish and angry and criffing disappointed, and then turns around and bolts, heading for the town like he can't stand being around Jango for one more second. Jango will never admit the way something in his chest lurches as Boba disappears around a stand of trees. But Jango is angry too, and the Jedi's words are ringing in his head, and that's 1,000 times easier to focus on than whatever ideas Boba's gotten from his new best friend. A clone. And Jango won't let some pale copy of himself turn his son against him. One problem at a time, though. For right now, there's a Jedi in the swamp. A Jedi who thinks an apology is going to make up for any part of what Jango has lost at his order's hands. Jango's breath rasps in his throat. Painful. Wrathful. And he turns around, snatching up his shirt, then pulling his armor down off the hook where it's hanging. The Jedi's in the swamp, and Jango saw what signatures caught his attention. That will make tracking him simple. And he's alone, distracted, and vulnerable. Jango has a high-powered blaster rifle with his name on it. And maybe killing one Jedi won't fix anything, but it sure as hell will make Jango feel better. Jango John picks up the trail of the Katarn just before the screaming starts. The cries are a child's, loud and panicked, and John doesn't even pause. He flings himself towards the sound, hurling himself around huge twisted trees and rotting logs through the shafts of golden sun that turn the water black. It's been disturbed, a clear track heading right towards the commotion, and John takes one look at the deep claw marks in a leaning tree and draws his lightsaber. Ahead of him, a motor roars to life and more shouts rise, adults this time rapidly approaching. But the child is still yelling, still panicked, and John feels a curl of disgust as a swamp speeder hurtles past him, spraying brackish water everywhere. The people on board are smugglers he recognizes from the town, Corellian and rough-looking, clearly afraid, and John is almost tempted to push their speeder right into the path of a particularly solid-looking tree, but he doesn't. The child needs saving more than revenge. John hits a patch of dry ground, rises. The Katarn is in a tree, huge and twisted and draconian, looming over the tiny figure of a 10-year-old boy who's clinging to the end of a branch, teetering dangerously. The limb is too thin for the Katarn, but all that's underneath is water, and soon... The Katarn takes a step out onto the branch, making it jerk, and the boy shouts in fear as his grip slips. John curses, flips his lightsaber up, and flings it like a spear even as he throws himself forward. He catches the boy in midair, twists, lands against the trunk of the tree, and flips, launching himself back to the patch of dry ground. At the same moment, the Katarn shrieks, John's lightsaber stabbing deep into its shoulder. It wrenches sideways, leaping from the tree, and John drops the boy on his feet, calls his lightsaber back, and leaps to meet it, snatching it out of the air as he falls towards the chrysalid. Its long, whip-like tail sweeps at him, and John spends half an instant of concentration, feels his own form waver like particles caught in a disruptor, and drops right through the blow, swings two-handed, and the Katarn screams as he cuts clean through its tail. John lands on its back, takes a step. With a vicious twist, the Katarn lashes out, massive claws raking down John's chest in a disemboweling blow. The pain registers, of course. It always does. John's used to pain, though, and lets himself be thrown back, takes the distance gladly, channels a touch of force that almost leaps forward to his command, and sweeps a hand down his chest. That burns, too. But the skin and muscle knits itself back together, seals in an instant. When he hits the trunk of the closest fallen tree, he spits out a mouthful of blood, straightens and flips his saber around, a silent dare. Hissing, the Katarn twists around to face him, hunkered down low and dangerous. Its rat-like face spits, showing dripping teeth. And John tilts his head, trying to catalog differences between this chrysalid and the regular Katarns he's faced. Bigger, this one, more heavily armored, and those teeth are probably poisoned. Its claws are longer, too. The spurs dripping something viscous and black. Dangerous, but not insurmountable. He just needs to be clever about it. Raising a hand, he focuses, feels at the force that curls through the plants beneath the water. There are roots and tangled runners, grasping limbs that come alive as he twists them up. They burst through the surface, wrap tight around the Katarn's legs, even as it hisses and tries to leap away. It's not enough to keep it contained for more than a moment, but John throws himself right at it, ducking the thrashing head and lashing out, opening a deep gash down its side before it wrenches free with a snarl. It lunges at him, claws flashing, and John leaps, twisting over its head, and flings a hand up as it rounds on him, focuses all his attention on the curl of the force in the palm of his hand, ducks his head, and pulls his hood down over his face and calls to the boy, "Close your eyes!" A brilliant flash of light sends the Katarn reeling back, clawing at his face, and John sends more plants winding up its body with a sweep of his hand. In the same moment, he lunges, bringing his lightsaber around in one hard, slashing blow, and even as long claws gouge deep into his side, he separates its head from its body. With a heavy splash, the corpse goes tumbling into the swamp, and John staggers, stumbles. He lands on one knee, lightsaber extinguishing, and stays there for a long moment, breathing hard. There's something wet bubbling in his lungs, blood sheeting down his side, but he closes his eyes, ignoring it for the moment. Fumbling a little, he clips his lightsaber to his belt again, then sinks down onto both knees, curls his hands together, and bows to the body that's slowly sinking into the mire. "I'm sorry for what was done to you," he murmurs, "because Katarns are a sacred animal to the Wookiees and deserve at least that much respect from him. This one was mad, twisted, like the last one John fought, and that was the doing of whatever Sith Lord built their laboratory here. But the creature itself is blameless, a victim. The Sith spare no one." It feels a little like John is breathing underwater, like he can't draw a full breath, and he grimaces, leans forward, presses a hand to his side, feeling for the torn flesh, and grits his teeth as he summons another surge of force healing. It tears through him, imperfect and rough, and John gasps, curling in on himself for just a second, but it works. It's not supposed to be pleasant, not supposed to be like temple healing. This is a battlefield medic's patchwork job, just enough to keep him moving, keep him fighting, and for that, it's sufficient. Shaking his head to get rid of the dizziness, John pushes to his feet, pulling the shreds of his tunic around himself, and mentally resigns himself to an afternoon of needlework. At some point, he'll need to call Nico, see about getting more clothes from the temple. Since Nico at least returns more frequently and can pass his request along. Until then, there's quite a bit of mending in John's near future. The glamorous, heroic life of a Jedi, John thinks wryly, and leaps across the gap, landing lightly on the spur of solid ground. His balance wavers and he lands, stumbles again, and drops to one knee, but pushes up as much as he can and raises his head, folding his hood back. "Are you all right?" he asks softly, and the boy, wide-eyed and brown-haired and wearing clothes that look about as worthy of the rubbish pile as John's, nods quickly. "They left me," he says, like this is the greatest indignity of the whole day, more important than his own near brush with death via Sith monster. "They left me as bait!" John breathes out, grim.
"I know," he says. "Your family?"
The boy shakes his head. "I don't have a family," he says, practically daring John to comment. Gravely, John inclines his head.
"Neither do I," he says. "Someone left me on the street when I was a year old."
There's a pause. Suspicious, startled. "Oh," the boy says, looking John over like he's waiting for him to reveal it to be a lie, and then says, "Me too. Not a year, but my dad disappeared." He frowns, wary, and says, "Why would someone leave a Jedi?"
"I wasn't a Jedi then," John points out. "Just a kid."
He considers for a moment, then brings his hands up, bows over them, and says,
"I am Jedi Master John Antilles. Thank you for helping me find the beast I was hunting."
Something in the boy's posture eases. "You're welcome," he says. "I'm Han, with the White Worms." He pauses, then scowls. "I was with the White Worms, but they left me, so now I'm not." A Corellian street gang, John thinks. No wonder they just up and left the boy. But if he can't go back to the gang, and he doesn't have any family to speak of on Corellia, that means he's left without anywhere to go. Apparently, John's call to Nico is going to be about a lot more than just clothes.
Would you like to stay with me instead? He asks, offering Han his hand. There are more beasts I need to deal with, but then I'll be leaving this moon. If you want, I can take you with me, or I can find someone who will take you in.
The Order has connections to orphanages and shelters in the core, after all. And normally they wouldn't take an Outer Rim boy, but Nico can arrange things. His family is old, renowned, and full of both Jedi and Senators. If he can't figure out something, no one can.
Me? Han says, incredulous. You want to take me with you? Why?
It's aggressive, almost angry. Not aimed at John, though. He can feel that much. And he hardly blames Han for the suspicion, given what's happened to him.
Yes, John says, quiet, steady. You're clever to have survived, and you're brave to have faced a chrysalid like you did. I would be honored if you would come with me.
There's a long, long pause as Han stares at him. Then, slow, Han nods and pointedly looks away. Doesn't say anything, but that's answer enough. And John smiles a little.
Thank you, he says seriously. We should get back to town before the wildlife comes out to see what happened.
Do you have a boat? Han asks and scowls. Those Slimo bastards took the only one that thing didn't sink.
John snorts softly. I'm a Jedi, he says. I don't need a boat. Can you climb on my back?
Han gives him a deeply skeptical look.
But you got hurt. I healed it.
John tugs the torn tunic aside to show Han the new scar, the lack of torn flesh.
It takes far more than one Katarn to kill a Jedi Master.
Oh, okay. Han relaxes a little, then nods. He waits until John turns, crouching again, and then scrambles up onto his back, wrapping bony arms around his neck. John gets an arm under his thighs, then straightens, and refuses to let himself waver. He's fine. Surviving the fight and rescuing those in danger is all that matters, and John did that. He can find a place to collapse once he gets back to the town.
Hang on, he warns, and leaps, a touch of the force carrying him across a wide strip of swamp to land lightly on a half-submerged log. It dips, cracks, but John is already off, launching himself at a high branch.
Han's arms go strangling tight even as he lets out a crow of elated surprise, and John huffs in amusement, landing on a wide branch. This time he manages to catch himself before his balance wavers, and he tips his head, asks,
"Good?"
"That's awesome," Han says. "Can you flip?" John winces, but looks for an open space between the trees. The sun is high, and the light on the water makes things swim a little. Or maybe that's the blood loss, but Han was just abandoned by the only companions he had, left stranded to give them time to flee. He's holding up well, but this is the least John can do for him.
Grip with your legs, too,
he says, and picks up a run along the wide branch. As it narrows, he ducks low, then leaps high as he grabs Han's knees, twisting over in a somersault that makes Han shout. The next branch is narrower, more rounded, and John hits it hard, jumps again and lands on a patch of dry ground between the trees with a heavy breath. Pauses there for a long moment, steadying himself, and then glances back.
Like that?
He asks, and Han grins at him.
Wizard,
he says, and John can't help but laugh a little, ducking his head. He moves more slowly, because at least in this part of the swamp, the water level is lower, and he can make long, easy steps between the patches of dirt.
My master taught me that, on a world with nothing but mountains and cliffs, he says, ducking beneath the low sweep of branches. She would take me up to the top and then race me to the bottom. Of course, Dark Woman's version of a race was a lot more cutthroat, even then. John had learned, though, and he's good at keeping his footing, good at force-assisted flight, good at acrobatics, too, which at least amuses Han.
Whole mountains?
Han asks, sounding impressed. What if you fell? Then I'd have a lot of chances to catch myself on the way down, John says, amused. Ahead of them, wide and mostly flat, is a half-rotted tree that's floating in the water, and he jumps to it, waits a moment to see if it will sink, and then kneels down. Here, take a seat. This will be easier than walking the whole way.
Are you going to make it fly?
Han asks, but he slides off John's back, sits down with a thump that makes the log rock. That would be inconvenient with all of these trees, John says, and settles down beside him, crossing his legs. He raises his hands, focusing, and the log shifts, jerks. Han sucks in a breath, but a moment later it starts to move, sailing over the surface with a light push as the water deepens. John keeps it afloat, keeps it moving, and it's a little easier, a little steadier, than just trying to keep jumping with the weight of a child on his back. He breathes out, relieved, and sunlight catches on metal, and John raises his head, turns just a little, to catch the flash of a blaster barrel between the trees. And when he breathes in, he can smell the burn of fuel from a jetpack. There's no sense of threat, though. Just a tangle of emotions that John can't even begin to pull apart. No intent to do harm, at the very least. And John turns back to the front, pulls his hood up, and lets Han's questions distract him. Django isn't a threat right now, and that's good enough for John.